You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on July 2nd, 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Phil Clark from SOAS in London and journalist Samira Shackle will join me to discuss the day's top stories, including still further chaos in Iraq, still further sectarian score settling in the Holy Land, recent ructions in Asia, and the peacemaking possibilities of Pakistani soap operas. Then our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, will sample the merchandise at South Tyrol's Murano Wine Festival.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a Viognier. Sort of deluxe.
It's a little bit cold now. Yeah.
Oh, it's fine. Different. So is everything up here today, but we're not complaining. Exactly. We're terribly happy.
And as if that wasn't enough.
Πώς θα λειτουργήσει, πώς θα υπάρξει ανάπτυξη.
Ξέρω ότι οι συνθήκες είναι δύσκολες.
Our Athens correspondent will be talking us through the highlights and indeed lowlights of Greece's TV schedules. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A typically action-packed 60 minutes ahead of us, but before all that, Bill Bingham has the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The discovery of a Palestinian teenager's body in Jerusalem has triggered clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. The protests further inflamed tension that reached a peak this week with the discovery of the bodies of three Israeli youths in the West Bank. The body, believed to be that of 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Koder, was discovered an hour after police were notified that a Palestinian teenager had been forced into a car in Jerusalem's Beit Hanina district. Israeli police say they're looking into whether the death was in retaliation for the killing of the three Israeli boys. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appealed for calm on all sides. Government spokesman Mark Regev says the PM has ordered an inquiry.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has instructed the police to conduct this investigation expeditiously, to get to the truth of the matter as soon as possible. He's also called upon everyone to not take the law into their own hands and not to interfere in the police investigation.
At least 9 civilians are reported to have been killed in an attack on a village in the Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine. The rebels are accusing the Ukrainian army of bombing and firing shells at the village of Luhanska. But Ukrainian officials say their forces were not in the area and are blaming the rebels themselves. Hundreds of people have been killed since a pro-Russian rebellion began in eastern Ukraine. A ceasefire ended on Monday. Survivors say at least 70 migrants have been lost at sea after their boat capsized off Sicily. The latest disaster to hit migrants trying to reach Italy emerged from a group rescued by the Italian Navy who've been speaking to UN workers. Thousands of migrants have tried to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa in recent days. Earlier, Italian officials said 45 people had died on another boat discovered 2 days ago. France's former president Nicolas Sarkozy has been placed under formal investigation in connection with suspected corruption and influence peddling. French media have reported he appeared before a court overnight after a day of questioning in Paris. Monsieur Sarkozy is believed to be the first French president to be held in police custody during an investigation. His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, and a high-ranking magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, have also been placed under formal investigation. US Senator John McCain has been holding talks in New Delhi with India's Foreign Minister, Sushma Swaraj, on Afghanistan and Iraq. His visit has been overshadowed by reports the US National Security Agency was authorized to spy on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party in 2010. Mr. McCain cancelled a news conference due to be held outside the country's foreign ministry after India summoned a senior US diplomat to the ministry over the spying press report. Indian Foreign Ministry spokesman Syed Akbaruddin says they had sought reassurances that any surveillance will not recur.
Our concerns have been expressed clearly to senior officials of the US Embassy here. In doing so, we have also sought an explanation of information contained in these press reports and an assurance that such authorizations will not be acted upon by the US government as far as Indian citizens, entities, and the government of India is concerned.
Police in Brazil say they've arrested 11 people and broken up an international gang involved in the illegal sale of World Cup tickets. The scheme is said to have earned the gang as much as $90 million per tournament and may have been operating for 4 World Cups. Some of the tickets seized were meant for sponsors, while others had been allocated to Brazil team officials. Police believe some of the tickets were sold to foreign tourists. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18:06 here in London, which is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Professor Phil Clark from London School of Oriental and African Studies and the journalist and Pakistan specialist Samira Shackle. Welcome both. We will start this evening in Iraq, whose politicians have today demonstrated that they're not about to let a little thing like an Islamist insurgency consuming a quarter of the country stop them from behaving with sectarian pettiness. The new Iraqi parliament has fractured along ethno-religious lines, Kurds and Sunnis withdrawing their legislators and scuppering attempts to form a new government. Samira, I'll ask you first, how big a step is this towards everybody really just giving up on Iraq as a single entity?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that every time since Saddam was ousted in after the 2003 invasion, every time there's been an election in Iraq, the process of appointing a new leader has involved a sort of very long, tense standoff and sort of deadlock for a few months. The point is now that the stakes are so much higher, as you said in your intro.
They don't really have time for standoffs.
Absolutely, and I think it sort of highlights in a way the reasons that the insurgency has been able to subsume the country, those sort of sectarian divisions, which is what caused the process today to collapse, are sort of also what's allowed that insurgency to take root. So I think it's certainly not something to be taken lightly, the idea of the country splitting up. That would have huge implications for elsewhere in the region, for Lebanon, for Syria. I think it's kind of difficult, given the sectarian flavour of what happened today and of the debate that's going on and sort of Kurdistan making more and more noises about independence. I think it's quite difficult not to see it as a step towards the possible partition of Iraq. But again, we should remember that this has happened every time they've had elections.
Phil, Samira there mentions the Kurds in particular, and the Kurds, it's really noticeable over the last few weeks, they're not even bothering to be ambiguous anymore. In fact, now Kurdistan's leader-ish Masoud Barzani says that Iraq is already effectively partitioned. He's promising a referendum on independence within months. I think it's fairly safe to say which way that vote will go. Is an independent Kurdistan really that bad an idea?
I think it's something that wouldn't be tolerated by much of the international community. I think there's clearly an enormous amount of support for it within northern Iraq itself. But I can't see that the US and the UN are tolerating this because they're petrified of a domino effect in Iraq, that if Kurdistan goes, it'll give rise to all manner of independence movement in other parts of the country. So I don't think that it's internationally palatable. But I think the other thing that it does show is that these divisions have been there since the invasion in 2003, and if the US's approach to stabilization was supposed to involve some process of reconciliation and building a coherent Iraq, they desperately failed on that front. So we're seeing these chickens come home to roost in the present.
Samira, just to return to the current status of things such as they are comprehensible. You quite rightly point out that every previous attempt to put a new Iraqi government together has come only after sort of months of sectarian standoff. But if the Kurds and Sunnis are not bluffing in withdrawing their politicians from the parliament, what happens then? Does Iraq have any sort of effective government at all?
It's difficult to say. And it's also, I think, in terms of an effective government, worth noting that during his two terms in the president's, as prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki has sort of taken power increasingly away from the government and the parliament. It's become more and more centralised in the role of the prime minister and so on. And so I think you could argue that those sorts of structures are already dysfunctional, even if they were filled, as it were. So I think certainly if the Kurds and Sudanese make good on their promise of withdrawing, that undermines any sort of claim to legitimacy. But I think that it wouldn't be a complete break with what's already happened. I think there's already sort of limited legitimacy for the government, and it's a government that's hugely unpopular with the population, I mean, across sectarian divides.
I mean, Phil Clark, is there, because I'm not sure I can see it, and perhaps Nouri al-Maliki can, but is there any plausible solution in which he is involved, or is he just irreducibly part of the problem at this stage?
I mean, he seems completely sidelined by all of the relevant players, and that includes the US, who have had to sort of tentatively back him for the best part of the last 7 or 8 years. And again, I come back to this issue that the US has failed on the military front after Saddam fell, and there's been a lot of focus on how disastrous the de-Ba'athification process was and the contribution that has made to what is now ISIS. But the political situation has been just as disastrous. I think the US hoped that al-Maliki would be this kind of softer version of Saddam, almost a strong man who could centralize power in his office and who didn't have to try and bring the rest of the country with him. I think that's the kind of problem that we're now seeing manifest itself fully at the moment.
Okay, well, we're going to move along now to Israel and Palestine, where in a development nonetheless depressing for its predictability, the body has been recovered of a Palestinian teenager who was seen being forced into a car in East Jerusalem yesterday, which was, of course, the same day funerals were held for 3 Israeli teenagers who had been abducted and murdered in similar fashion. Palestinian sources and Israel Defense Force Radio are both saying that the killing of Mohammed Abu Khader, who was 17, was an apparent revenge attack. Netanyahu has condemned the murder, as one would hope he would. But yesterday, of course, he was saying about the Israeli teenagers killed, may God avenge their blood. Samira, does Netanyahu bear, I mean, obviously the overwhelming responsibility for this horrible crime lies with whoever committed it, but is Netanyahu's rhetoric helping?
Oh, certainly not. Certainly not helping. As you said, I think that, I mean, he has condemned the murder of the Palestinian teenager, as you said, but given the context where you have the response to the equally abhorrent abduction and murder of the 3 Israeli teenagers, a sort of policy of collective punishment of the entire Palestinian population, I think it's sort of not difficult to see where the idea of revenge sort of comes from. And it's such a depressing cycle, this sort of vengeance and violence, and it's seems sort of like history stood still for the last sort of 6 decades. It's a real shame.
It's not just the last 6 decades. It's about the 200, 2,400 decades before that as well. Others who have condemned the killing of this Palestinian kid, to the credit of all concerned, include the families of the 3 dead Israeli boys, who've said there's no difference between Arab blood and Jewish blood. Murder is murder. Is anyone likely to listen to them?
I think that is quite a powerful statement, and we see this in a lot of political acts, that sometimes it's the people who are closest to the violence who often have the most humane reactions to it. There is something powerful about families coming out and saying, look, we don't want to see further bloodshed, enough has been done, we've got to find a more peaceful way through this. And I mean, maybe sort of politically the leaders don't listen to that kind of thing, but I think within communities that kind of thing is extremely powerful. So I mean, the tragedy here is that there is really no political momentum on either side of the border for any kind of peace. It's purely tit for tat. It's a spirit of revenge. And so in some ways you would hope that communities start to show leadership here, the kind of leadership their national leaders aren't showing.
You're quite right there in that both sides are escalating the rhetoric. Hamas are now blaming Israel for the murder of Mohammed Khadir, just as Israel was blaming Hamas for the murder of the 3 Israeli boys. This is a decision, of course, the leaderships on both sides could make. They could decide to de-escalate matters rather than escalate them. Samira, is it the case that really neither leadership is terrifically interested in peace, that the current state of, you know, tension and near war actually suits them?
I think that's certainly the case. I mean, that's but before today's events, that's something that's certainly been said about the Israeli government's response, that this sort of came at a time when Hamas and Fatah had formed a unity government, that wasn't in the Israeli government's interests. And I think that's the thing about this disproportionate response to what you know, an abhorrent crime, but a crime that should be tried as a crime. To sort of respond by punishing a whole population empowers the extremist elements on the other side. It empowers those who advocate violence and not those who advocate talks in the way of peace. So I think it's certainly true that it sort of serves the most extreme elements on either side to sort of push that violence onwards.
Phil, just finally on this, following up that point of Samira's about treating acts like this as a crime, which should be investigated by police, and then perpetrators should be tracked down and arrested and tried. Both Israel and now Palestine still insist on regarding things like this as acts of war rather than crime. Why is that?
I think that's a really important point because it shows how quickly these individual moments of criminality can blow up into something much larger. I mean, what's fascinating to me is that Israel loves to paint itself as a place that respects the rule of law, that it is well-ordered, that it is rights-respecting in a way that its neighbours aren't. But if we see the political rhetoric around these most recent killings, we have very good reason to question that point. And so I think that's absolutely right. That these are individual criminal matters. They should be they should be a matter for police, and they should be a matter for courts, and they should be dealt with in a very domestic way.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Phil Clark from SOAS, and Samira Shackle. When we return, we will be focusing on Asia. Do stay tuned.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity. We bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me is Phil Clark from the School of Oriental and African Studies and the journalist Samira Shackle discussing the day's big stories. We're going to look towards Asia now. And 17 years ago yesterday, the Union flag was hauled down on Hong Kong Island and the British colony was returned to the sovereignty of China. Now, neither party has since been entirely comfortable with the arrangement, and the anniversary of the handover has become a traditional venting of Hong Kong's chafing at autocracy. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out yesterday demanding universal suffrage, to which one can both sincerely and sarcastically wish them good luck with that. Phil, first of all to you, how worried is Beijing that this sort of thing might catch on?
I think they're quite worried. I think the noises coming out of Beijing in the last couple of days suggest a certain amount of disquiet that they've seen protests in Hong Kong before. So this isn't the first time that there's been political protest, but it's the scale that worries Beijing. I think they feel this is unprecedented, and if it's allowed to develop sort of unchecked, it could become something much bigger. So I think they are worried about that.
The scale was extraordinary. The police estimated it at around 100,000. The organisers estimated it at about 500,000. So even if we draw a mean between those two, that is a fairly significant chunk of Hong Kong's population. Samira, do you get the sense that Beijing maybe will put up with this kind of thing once a year, but probably no more than that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not great with protest, are they, Beijing? I think
not that, keen.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's it's not the same as mainland China. Of course, it's got its own legal system. They've got those sort of rights like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly enshrined in Hong Kong. But that's not to say that sort of unfettered, wide-scale public protest is something that will be tolerated. There'll be worries about contagion, especially given sort of movement of people between the two places and so on. More will be tolerated in Hong Kong, you know, as you say, once a year. And I mean, during the, I think we were here a few weeks ago talking about the Tiananmen sort of anniversary.
Indeed, which is also observed in Hong Kong.
Yeah, it was exactly observed in Hong Kong and not anywhere else in China. But I don't think they're going to want to either be seen to be bowing to protests or to sort of allow that to continue.
Phil, I was in Hong Kong 17 years ago, watching it all happen, which in practice meant mostly trying to cope with Hong Kong's climate at this time of year, which is like being in a restaurant kitchen all day, every day. There were at the time, I recall, a few optimists who thought that Hong Kong might end up doing for China what West Berlin did for the USSR, this sort of like this small kind of seed of democracy, which... Actually, this metaphor is going nowhere. But you know what I'm saying. Does that still seem likely, or did it ever?
I don't think it ever has been likely. But I think that the Chinese approach to Hong Kong is fascinating. That there's a feeling that Beijing has to tolerate these freedoms in Hong Kong because Hong Kong is this international hub. It's a vibrant commercial site. It's in some ways a kind of a bridge between China and the West. But that has limits. And I think maybe what we're seeing this week is some of the citizens of Hong Kong kind of testing those limits. And it's interesting, too. I think we'd got a sense internationally that maybe the Occupy spirit had kind of died away, that the Arab Spring had moved on and then New York City had moved on, and that kind of zeitgeist moment was gone. Well, maybe we're seeing sort of a minor version of this sort of cropping up in Asia for the first time. We haven't really seen an Occupy sort of phenomenon there. Maybe that's what this is.
There was a movement called Occupy Central, who indeed held an unofficial referendum asking people if they wanted universal suffrage, and managing 800,000 people to vote in it. Samira, did you see it that way? Did it remind you of those people camping out in New York and London and various other places around the world whenever it was they were doing that?
I think it's slightly different given, I mean, obviously you can draw comparisons, but I think context is quite important there, and it's different when you're actually asking just for universal suffrage, which is something we kind of take for granted in the US and the UK and a lot of the places where the Occupy movements were, where it was more a sort of campaign against capitalist values and social injustice. So while there are parallels, I think in a way the stakes are higher in Hong Kong, I think, or it's more sort of fundamental rights.
I mean, China is saying there will be universal suffrage for the 2017 elections. Universal has a fairly significant asterisk next to it. It will be for approved candidates only, by which they obviously mean approved by Beijing. Do you think that will be significant, Phil, to take the heat out of these demonstrations?
It could do, but that's a gamble by Beijing, and it relies on these protesters, in fact, accepting that carrot. And again, I think this is still a volatile situation. It's unclear how long this could last. It's unclear whether the protesters would be placated by that kind of offer. I don't think we should ever underestimate a bit of citizen power, particularly in places where the state may not expect it. You can catch a government off guard very, very quickly. So I think you'd have to ask us again in a couple of weeks' time.
Okay, well, Beijing may presently be more exercised by events in Tokyo, where Shinzo Abe's government appears ever more determined that Japan has served enough of its constitutionally enforced penance for its militarism in the 30s and 40s. Having recently relaxed a ban on exporting arms, Japan has now relaxed a ban on exporting soldiers. Its so-called self-defense forces will be permitted to fight overseas. Phil, first of all, why is Shinzo Abe... decided to... the spin he's putting on this is that he is reinterpreting the Constitution and not revising it. So why not a referendum?
Yeah, this is very legally clever, this, I think, that he's kind of framed the discussion in these terms, because it does save him having to go to the population to get the okay for this move. And I think he would realise that within huge swathes of Japanese society that there is real reluctance to remilitarise the state in any shape or form. I think the memory of the Second World War goes profoundly profoundly, deeply. So he would want to avoid that. But this is part of sort of, you know, Abe's broader sort of a re-engagement of Japan in the world. And he's been very clear about this in foreign policy terms, saying that we need a new Japan, we need a new relations internationally, and being a military force around the globe seems to be part of that.
Samira, there's been obviously some disquiet within Japan about this. There's been demonstrations against it, and indeed one self-immolation in protest. How enthusiastic is the rest of the region likely to be about the idea of Japan being a proper conventional military force again?
I mean, I doubt anyone will be that enthused about it, really, least of all China. There's sort of obviously long-standing military history there. I think, though, that, you know, as Phil said, it's something that the government's been working towards for a while. They've been talking about the need to sort of loosen up on that rule, so to sort of participate more actively in the world stage. And, you know, they've stressed they won't be getting involved in multilateral operations like Iraq. I don't think that will necessarily relax the region. I mean, the sort of the new definition of being able to act in collective defence that could cover, for instance, firing down missiles from North Korea that could be pointed towards the US, that's an ally, you know, so on. So I think it's certainly those regional partners, sort of neighbours, sorry, who'll be watching it the most closely.
Phil, just finally on this, do you think people might be slightly less nervous about this if Japan actually eventually undertook an honest accounting of its past behaviour? I mean, no one really reminds Germany having an army anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's almost as though this constitutional provision has become a substitute in Japanese society for really dealing with the past in that regard. I think there's some truth to that, that, you know, people can be anxious about this issue of militarization, but you don't see a popular push for dealing with those events. I mean, what's fascinating to me too is, in fact, Japan have had peacekeepers in South Sudan for the last 18 months, and there's been some rumblings in Japanese society that, in fact, that those Japanese actors have been engaging in military activities. So in some ways, the horse has already bolted on this issue. Abe has found sort of sneaky ways, I guess, to start this process before he has to deal with the constitutional issues.
Well, finally then, we have an interesting peacemaking initiative on the subcontinent where one Indian television company hopes that overwrought television drama can succeed where other ideas have failed. Zindagi Television has launched a channel which will broaden nothing but Pakistani soap opera to its Indian viewers. Samira, how much demand is there likely to be for Pakistani soap opera?
They're seen as actually really good, though. So they've got quite a good critical reputation in that sort of area. So I think they'll probably be watched quite closely. I mean, I was quite surprised that they weren't aired there already, because there's certainly on the sort of South Asian channels here, there's a lot of crossover. Bollywood is very popular and dominant in Pakistan since the laws were loosened up that allowed Indian Indian imports of culture, as it were, to come into Pakistan a few decades ago. I think there's certainly scope to have lots of demand. But that said, of course, India is very much the big brother. It's sort of the juggernaut in terms of movies, in terms of music. So it's already quite a busy market.
What impression of Pakistani society and Pakistani life do Pakistani soap operas tend to portray? Are they sort of obsessed with a particular strata of society?
There's a mix, really, but it's generally quite closely focused on sort of family dramas. But there's a mix. It's, I think, quite often sort of middle class, average families. But there's also sort of there's the sort of rich elite of sort of aspirational dramas as well.
Phil, do you think that the Zindagi are being a little bit optimistic in hoping that this will further understanding between nations? And I'm just thinking in terms of obviously the nation from which we both hail is popularly represented overseas by various soap operas. I'm not really sure how much you would learn about Australia from watching them. Can this do any good?
I always think it plays some sort of role. I think it's often these kind of more subtle cultural pushes that can kind of lead to large-scale cultural change. I mean, without big political dialogue, of course, nothing really changes. But slowly, you know, carefully having populations get more used to seeing different faces on their TV screen, being exposed to kind of, you know, normal life, you know, can kind of start to play on people's minds. I mean, I've seen something similar in Central Africa, where I do a lot of my work. There's been a very perhaps the most popular soap opera in the whole region is a radio program out of Rwanda about everyday villages, which has got huge sort of purchase in Burundi and Congo. And people talk about it. And in some ways, it's the only thing that is making Congolese start to see Rwandans as normal. Our political dialogue has failed, but radio soap operas in that case seem to have had some sort of effect. So, yeah, I think it has some sort of role.
And Samira, does this have soft power potent?
Maybe, although it could go both ways. I'm thinking of my grandma, who's Pakistani, but loves to watch Indian soap operas, but sometimes uses it as evidence to show that Indians being devious.
Samira Shackle and Phil Clark from SOAS, thank you both very much for joining us. We will have to leave it there.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Charlotte McDonald Gibson will run us through the day's news from Brussels. We'll speak to the man behind a new Brazilian football photography exhibition, and we'll hear what's hot and not on the box in Greece. But before we get started on that, Bill Bingham has the headlines.
The discovery of a Palestinian teenager's body in Jerusalem has triggered clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. The protests further inflame tension that reached a peak this week with the discovery of the bodies of three Israeli youths in the West Bank. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appealed for calm on all sides. At least nine civilians are reported to have been killed in an attack on a village in the Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine. The rebels are accusing the Ukrainian army of bombing and firing shells at the village of Luhanska, but Ukrainian officials say their forces were not in the area and are blaming the rebels themselves. Survivors say at least 70 migrants have been lost at sea after their boat capsized off Sicily. Earlier, Italian officials said 45 people had died on another boat discovered 2 days ago. France's former president Nicolas Sarkozy has been placed under formal investigation in connection with suspected corruption and influence peddling. French media have reported he appeared before a court overnight after a day of questioning in Paris. His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, and a high-ranking magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, have also been placed under formal investigation. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill, and welcome back to Midori House. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, it's the turn of Charlotte McDonald Gibson in Brussels. Charlotte, did anybody actually go to work today?
Considering how late I was kept up by the honking from football supporters last night, I doubt it. You'd hope somebody did, but I certainly struggled.
Belgium were touted before this World Cup as something of a dark horse. Are people starting to at least dare to believe that they might give this a shake?
Well, I think there was a little bit of scepticism after the first few matches. They did win all three Greek rounds, but they didn't quite have the energy, the aggression and attack that people had hoped. So there's a bit of scepticism in the press, but after the match last night against USA, which really was an excellent match, and they really showed so much promise, there is that blossoming of hope once again, and the flags are flying, and everyone's getting behind the team. So there's a real energy around Brussels today.
I mean, it's possibly a question in which we're getting three games ahead of ourselves, because that's how far Belgium still are from winning the World Cup, and they are going to have to play some serious people en route. But has there been any discussion of what effect it might have on the country if Belgium managed to win it? You still have an extremely divided country, which still doesn't have a government. Could they be a significant unifying force?
Well, I think that's why people here are getting so excited, and also elsewhere in the world, why there's so much attention on the team. I don't think, honestly, I don't think anyone really thinks they're going to win the World Cup, but certainly the idea that both the North, the Flemish-speaking North and the French-speaking South, are uniting behind the team when they can't even unite behind a government, In the elections last month, 2 million people out of the population of 10 million voted for separatist parties. So there's such a strong separatist sentiment here. And this idea that, suddenly they're getting behind a team which has players from Flanders, it has players from Wallonia, and everybody's supporting them. I think that's what's causing this, real excitement both here and, abroad, and the attention focusing on this team.
On the subject of electorates making slightly inconvenient decisions, the first sitting is due of the MEPs returned after the European elections in May, which, there's going to be a plurality of far-right cranks, Eurosceptic wreckers, not really the kind of people that the EU establishment really wanted elected to the Parliament. How is this going to go?
Well, the first session was yesterday, in fact, and we really did get a taste of things to come. As you mentioned, these elections last month brought sort of a real surge in these Eurosceptic parties. Something like 30% of the seats in the 751-seat parliament are with these parties. And so, yes, yesterday when the Ode to Joy, which is the EU national anthem, even though I'm not sure that many people know that, and when that was played in the chamber, the 24 MEPs from UKIP, from the Eurosceptic UK Independence Party, they actually stood up and turned their backs. So we had that yesterday, and then today we've had quite a lively debate in the chamber again between UKIP MEPs, also the Front National's Marine Le Pen. She got up and called the EU brutal and disconnected. So we really are seeing these voices come out for the first time this week.
So is it likely that this particular European Parliament is going to be able to accomplish anything, even if it wants to, given that it seems largely staffed by people who are determined that it won't accomplish anything?
Well, their voices are definitely louder, and we're going to hear more of them. But at the end of the day, the majority of the seats in the Parliament, 70% of the seats, are held by pro-EU MEPs, people who support this idea of Project Europe. So they're not really going to have much blocking force when it comes to legislation, and absolutely the Parliament now has more power than it ever has done before. So they will be noisy, they will be difficult, we will hear them more, but in terms of their actual power, not really that significant.
Well, the lucky country saddled with having this parliament on their watch in their presidency, at least in the early stages, is Italy. You're off to Rome, I believe, with the rest of the Brussels press corps tomorrow. What can we look forward to from an Italian EU presidency?
Well, the Italians are in an interesting position because Matteo Renzi, the Italian PM, he was one of the few people to actually do quite well at these European Parliament elections. So he's in quite a unique position now. He's got really good clout to try and take his agenda a little bit further in the next 6 months. I mean, the first thing he did today in his speech to the European Parliament was talk about how important British membership was to Europe. Obviously, this has now been thrown into question after the Parliament elections and because of this nomination of Jean-Claude Juncker as Commission President last week. So that's interesting to see that he's really gone straight in there and said this is really important that Britain stays in the EU. So we should see more of that in the next 6 months. Also, another policy that he's very keen to pursue is shifting the focus, the economic focus of the EU from these austerity policies, which were largely to blame for this shift to the right last month, and towards more growth-orientated policies, more investment. So we're really going to see a lot of that from him in the next few days, in the next 6 months.
And what does Italy want for itself from its term as president?
Well, I mean, the one issue that they're really being very vocal about in the run-up to it is this issue of the migrant boats. There's some terrible tales already this summer of these boats sinking and migrants and refugees and asylum seekers dying at sea. Italy really is bearing the brunt because these boats are coming from North Africa and they're landing in Italian waters and Italian ports. So they really want more money from the EU. They're spending an awful lot of money. This is one of the things that's making the government unpopular because they do have a far right, which is questioning whether they should be spending all this money. So we're going to see some very strong appeals from Italian government officials for more support from the EU for this really crucial operation of saving lives at sea.
Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us. After the break, our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé will be sampling some boozy treats from South Tyrol in North Italy.
Each year, the Pre-Pic Day honours photographers who pull focus on challenging environmental issues. Monocle Films reports on the alchemy of this year's images and explores their potential to affect change.
The still image has as much power as it ever had, in spite of the ubiquity of the printed image on the internet and films, videos and everything. I think this exhibition shows that single images can have as much raw power and emotion and can engage so strongly with the senses that you simply cannot forget them.
You can watch our report on the 2014 Prix Pictet by heading to the film section at monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, all this week, the briefing has been coming from the alpine expanses of South Tyrol, where our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and the Monocle 24 team are examining the charms and challenges of the North Italian region. It's an area increasingly well known for its wineries, and that's perhaps just one of the reasons why South Tyrol plays host to one of the world's most exclusive wine events. The Murano Wine Festival brings together 300 wineries from the region and more than 120 international winemakers for the three-day event. The man in charge of the festival is Helmut Kircher. He joined Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson earlier today.
So South Tyrol has about 4,500 hectares of vineyards, and we have different microclimates, you said it, and we have different wines in the valleys. We have like Eisacktal, like Finchgau, and there it's good for a white variety. Another place is good for red variety, and therefore we have really a good panel of wines, no, from the red to the white, and also to the sweet wines, no, and the highest. The vineyards are on 1,300 meters above the sea level at the Mendel Pass. This is really particular. Sweet wines are from there, and it's really particular. And with the changing of the climate, we see that the vineyards now they are on 400, 500 meters. We have also in Finchgau one vineyard of, I think, 1,000 meters above sea level, and they have plants from Pinot Noir, no? Mm. And it's really particular minerality and good acidity, and therefore the wines are, I think, unique and very special. And therefore, the wines from South Tyrol, not only the red, also the white wines, they are high considered in all Italy. I think we have the best white wines of Italy. Actually, one of the wineries, the winery of Terlano, they have a new wine on the market. It's the most expensive white wine from Italy. And I see, for me personally, for evaluations and so on, I see that the white wines from South Tyrol are always on the first places.
And we can almost see the Terlano from here if these trees weren't in front of us. It's pretty close, yes. Is it not? I guess without further ado, we've got this red sitting in front of the. I'm ready as well. Tell us, what are we going to sample first?
Okay, this is a wine from South Tyrol, and we have a variety in South Tyrol. It's an indigenous variety. It's called Fernach. In Italian, you say schiava. I don't know if there is an English word, no, but it's well known like Fernach. And this was for some years, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I think the only red wine which was produced in South Tyrol. It was the best which they produced, but it's not a rich wine. It's not a high-class wine, how I would describe it, but it's, I would say, a joke wine. No? The good acidity, good fruits, and it's good to drink the wine with some particular dishes like knödel. No? I don't know how you say it.
I'm a fan of knödel.
Ms. Nelson knows knödel well.
We are all well acquainted with the knödel.
And you can also combine it with speck. No,
it's speck as well. Now, you're also speaking her language as well.
My first question this morning was, where are we going where I can find a good speck producer? And my first question to you was going, what do you drink with speck? Because it's incredibly fatty.
Here we go.
And this seems to be the right
you
thing because it's thin.
You drink Fernach.
Because
no?
It's dry and it's thin.
Yeah, right.
And
zum Wohl. Or we say Prost.
What do you say?
Yeah, you say Prost or zum Wohl, no?
Both.
Both,
I think.
Yes, I yeah. think, yeah.
Okay.
Zum Wohl. Do you ever get anything done?
Salute.
Just discussing exactly. What language you're going to be talking.
Oh, salute in Italian.
Yes, salute in Italian.
Very nice. Where's the speck?
It's light and it's Mm-hmm.
That's quite sharp.
It's light, and this lightness is good for a speck, no? And therefore, it's the perfect combination for speck.
It is.
Platter's on its way. Yes.
Thank you.
Just in case you're worried.
I was getting quite desperate.
And you see, it's not a rich wine. It's not a power wine. No, but I think this is a good expression for Südtirol, for the territory of Südtirol.
It's like at this time of the day, without getting drunk immediately.
I like the immediate.
How important is the Südtirol, or how important is wine to the Südtirol brand? Because it's interesting now, when you look at certain bottles, you'll also see Südtirol branding on those bottles as well. So do they see this as one of the engines as much as tourism, would you say?
Mm-hmm. It's very important.
I mean, geographically, I was surprised by how much of the space is taken up by these vineyards, because it is not a greatly known area of great wine producing. I mean, obviously, you're doing your best, Heinrich, to try and change all this. But in terms of visually, you just think that you do nothing but make wine around here.
I think wine is very important, and much more important than Speck, actually. Because they produce it here, they do it here, it grows here, because the Speck they only produce here. Mm. It's coming from somewhere else.
And you must think, Südtirol is a small area. Mm. So when you think that in Italy, all the country, we have more than 100,000 wineries. In Südtirol, we have, I think, not more than 200, no? And therefore, for Südtirol, for the branding, it's very good. It's one part is gastronomic part, the dishes, the particular products we have, speck, and the wine is very important. Mm.
You brought another wine in?
Yes, it looks I saw a peak of a white. It looks like we're going to the extreme end of the country. This is from Sicily, is it not?
Right. So before we tasted the wines from the extreme north, now we taste the wine from the extreme south, no? And Sicily is extreme south. This is a particular international variety, but it's good for Sicily. It's Viognier, it's a region of France. And also Sicily has a good production for white wine. Mm-hmm. It's warm, but inside of the island, there are cold climates, and they are good for white wines. And this is wine with some aromas from ananas or some exotic fruits, no? And well-body, good to drink, and good to combine with fish.
And even just smelling it now, it smells like a Viognier Plus. It's got more to it than your average Viognier. It's sort of got that sort of punchy sunlight has come through and been distilled into the glass. Shall we have a taste?
Salute. We do apologise to our listeners.
Now you say salute. We are in Sicily.
We're in Sicily.
I'm
from Sicily. Yeah, I think you're right. It is a Viognier sort of deluxe.
Wow.
It's a little bit cold now. Yeah.
Oh, it's fine. Different. So is everything up here today, but we're not complaining. Exactly. We're terribly happy.
Yeah, very, very good.
And this would be eaten with what? With seafood? Mm-hmm. So when you're in Südtirol, are you drinking local wines in the majority part, or do you actually find wines from other parts of Italy making themselves onto menus?
No, you find wines from other parts of Italy, but mainly from Südtirol, because you have to the experience which you have to make here in Südtirol is to work with our product, with wines from Südtirol. But then you can combine, when you eat fish dishes or other dishes, then you can combine some Italian wine from Tuscany, from Campania, or where else. No.
Helmut Kirche of the Murano Wine Festival there, speaking to Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. Now, in a moment, we will be reviewing the week's television in Greece, but first, a song to take us there. This is because you'll see what we've done here. We're going to talk about television, so this is Television. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now to review the best and or the worst of the arts. Today we're talking TV, specifically Greek TV, with Natalie Savarikas, our correspondent in Athens. Natalie, we're going to start, I guess, at the start of the day, which is a new morning show, which, I mean, it's called Happy Day, which is a bad start right there. And I don't really speak Greek, so I didn't really follow the YouTube footage I saw, but I get the impression that was probably just as well.
Indeed. It's this
happy-go-lucky morning show. It aims to offer some sort of lighter alternative to the other morning programs, which are usually heavy-duty news. But I must admit that this just kind of has elements of everything I really hate in Greek TV, because I don't know why happy essentially needs to come across as so superficial, full of synthetic smiles, perfectly manicured women with like this, the heavy duty hairstyles, and just so fake. And they just want to come across as very cozy, but I think it's just an, you know, extremely superficial.
I've never really understood myself the premium on people looking happy on morning television. I think there'd be a huge market for people who just look miserable, underslept and hungover. We do, however, have a clip of Happy Day. You can't see it from this, but you can hear it.
Κορίτσι μου, κάτω να φέρω και την καφετιέρα, περίμενε.
Καλημέρα, καλημέρα, καλημέρα.
Τι κάνεις?
Και καλή μας αρχή, έλα να σας φιλήσω.
Λοιπόν, καφέ σας βάζω σήμερα εγώ από αύριο την Αίγιο.
Natalie, what was all that about? It sounded ghastly.
Well, that's where the presenter, Eleni Tsolakis, is essentially welcoming her like collaborator Stamati Tsimtsili, who's wearing a ridiculously short skirt. The anchor is holding this pot of freshly brewed coffee, and they kiss and say hi and welcome the audience with all these like very synthetic and happy natured smiles.
Okay, well, let us never speak of or indeed think about Happy Day again and move on instead to Sora Sintagi, which is a new cookery show.
Yeah, actually, it's quite nice. It's a cookery show, but it also explores different corners of Greece, like the ones off, you know, the usually like the tourist track. So it's this very alternative chef, very famous, full of tattoos, who's traveled the world. He goes around these regions, speaks to the local producers. They don't necessarily need to be very talented chefs. I mean, many of them don't even know how to cook an egg. But essentially, he cooks with them, he chats with them, explores the local product. It's quite nice and very different for Greece.
Okay, well, we have a clip of that as well.
Θα ψιλοκόψω μέσα λίγο βασιλικό. Μην κοιτάς εμένα, την πιπεριά, κοιτά μου την κάψη.
Well, I, for one, appreciated the incongruous country and western soundtrack, but what were they cooking there?
Well, essentially, it's lobster, but the scenery is spectacular. I mean, the backdrop is the sea of the island of Naxos, and it's a local fisherman. They've just fished the lobster, and they're about to cook the produce, and so he's teaching him how to cook it. They're having a small chat. They're talking about the ingredients, and it's just a beautiful introduction to the island, to the people, and everything it has to offer beyond the usual and traditional tourist look, which tends to be quite boring, especially in Greece.
Okay, well, finally, we want to move along to Ston Eniko, which is a political show in which the audience put questions to politicians. It's a format which we see all over the world. I mean, the British equivalent is the increasingly bizarre bear pit known as Question Time. In Greece, however, there would be no shortage of pointed questions for audiences to ask, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, this is something that has been missing a lot from the Greek media scene. I mean, the opportunity to give Greeks the opportunity to vent, essentially, and talk one-on-one to their politicians. And that's something that's been missing. The Greek journalists are often accused of not asking the right questions, the ones that really hurt. And so that this one has been greeted with a lot of enthusiasm. And I can tell you, I mean, what you hear from the ordinary Greeks is very impressive, and it goes straight to the heart of politicians who very often cannot answer the question. One of the drawbacks, nonetheless, is that the journalist who's in charge, the anchor, doesn't really allow the politicians, I mean, helps them in a way, if you will, and kind of interrupts the questioning when it gets really hard.
Natalie, thank you very much. That's the wrap-up of Greek television there from our correspondent in Athens, Natalie Savarikas. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Phil Clark from London SOAS and the journalist Samira Shackle. Today's show was produced by Alan John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs. At 2200 hours London time, I'll be back with Nancy Durham for The Monocle Daily. This show returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.